Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we're going to have our second show on the Iran protests that have been going on. And I'm very happy to have Dr. Ariana Tabatabai on the show to discuss this second round of, I guess we could say, Iran protest discussions. So first of all, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Chelsea.
For our listeners, Dr. Tabatabai is a senior associate with the Proliferation Prevention Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the director of curriculum and a visiting assistant professor at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She's also an international civilian consultant for NATO, a columnist for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, a Truman National Security Fellow, and a 2017-2018 postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for the Sciences and International Affairs. And her writing has appeared in numerous outlets, and she has done a lot of other media and press interviews. So she's a fantastic guest with a fantastic background for this topic. So I'm so happy to have you on the show, Dr. Tabatabai. To start off with... Oh, yes, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say thank you. And that was a very comprehensive overview of my bio.
Yes, there's so much more, too. So I was trying to edit it down as much as possible, but I didn't want to take away all of your amazing accolades. So to start off with, like, what has caused these protests? I mean, we had a show already that discussed the protests, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on it as well.
Sure. Well, the protests really can go back to earlier in December 2017 when President Rouhani unveiled the budget for the upcoming year, the upcoming Persian year, which starts in March of 2018 and goes on until March 2019. In unveiling the budget, he also started to talk about a number of issues relating to corruption, to the shadow economy, and to other issues that sort of people have known about for a long time, but that had never really been this formally acknowledged, certainly in such a high-profile way by one of the you know, top officials in the country, the second top official in the country, in fact. So following that and the fact that, you know, you haven't really seen a whole lot of economic benefits from the nuclear deal, a lot of change in people's purchasing power, unemployment, all the issues that affect their day-to-day lives, all of these things started to sort of turn into a snowball, essentially, and started to spill over into the streets of first the city of Mashhad, which is one of the more conservative major cities in the country and the northeast of region of the country, and then eventually to the rest of the country as well. One more thing to think about as well is that, you know, in the past few weeks, we had started to see a lot of commentary, memes, GIFs or GIFs, I still don't know how you're supposed to pronounce that, about the price of eggs and poultry and other sort of daily goods that people need. And those prices, the price hikes had started to really get, you know, generate a lot of criticism by hardliners, but also by the broader population. So all of these the issues and events combined are what has led people to come out and take the streets and protest.
And so this proposed budget that Rouhani has put out, and there's word that it's been leaked, and that's part of this. What sort of things are in this proposed budget that are really upsetting the public of Iran?
I don't know that it's necessarily the budget itself that is upsetting people as much as it's actually the what is going on around it. You know, the budget is pretty standard in some ways. And I'm not an economist, so I won't go into the details of the budget. That's a question for somebody who's a lot better with numbers than I am. But generally speaking, there is nothing outrageous in the budget from my perspective. So what is going on, I think, is the fact that you have, you know, the nuclear deal was delivered now more than 2 years ago. It's the implementation process started 2 years ago. Rouhani ran two campaigns and was elected twice on the promise of economic recovery. Really, that's the major thing that he's promised. And you know, for the average Iranian, despite all the promises, despite all the fanfare around, you know, the nuclear deal and the normalization and the delegations visiting Iran from, you know, Western countries, from other countries to create partnerships, economic ties, etc. None of those things are felt by the average Iranian, which is what is sparking the discontent that you're seeing today.
And you just mentioned a little bit ago that the protests started in Mashhad. What is the significance of them starting in Mashhad versus a big modern city like Tehran, a capital?
So, you know, Mashhad is not typically known for being the center of protests and reform movements in Iran. You know, these things typically start in other cities, and Tehran, of course, where you have the majority of the population. And the city of Tabriz is well known in the northwest for having been the center and the initiator of a number of movements as well. Mashhad is not typically the front runner here. It's certainly not the flag bearer for reform movements and protests. So that's an interesting departure from previous protest movements that we had seen. The other thing too is that, you know, this is one of the major Shia holy sites for all Shias, but especially in Iran. It's where the eighth imam is buried. His mausoleum is there. It's a very, it's a much more conservative, much more religious city than most of the other major cities in Iran, which is not to say that, of course, everybody is, you know, religious and everybody's, you know, conservative and so on. But it is typically seen as more conservative, more religious. And so the fact that this is the time, this is the place where this time around protests are starting is pretty interesting. And it kind of indicates that there is something different about these protests that we hadn't necessarily seen in 2009, for example.
So I've heard rumors that there's a thought out there that Rouhani has angered one of the conservative religious figures. And what you said about Mashhad seems to connect with this. Have you heard these rumors, and do you think that part of the protests are sparked by this idea of competition between conservatives?
Yeah, I mean, this is really the kind of infighting that is now spilling into the streets, really, the infighting that had started within the establishment, right? The question of, you know, how much opening up of the Iranian economy, of the political system, is enough or too much? How much of it is needed to generate the change and bring about the economic benefits of the nuclear deal? Was the nuclear deal really the best way to approach Iran's economic issues to begin with? What does the Islamic Republic want to look like, right? These are questions that had already started that people were having within the establishment. And one example that maybe that's what you're alluding to, is that a while ago there was this sort of conservative cleric who had asked for a concert to be banned in Mashhad, you know, sort of arguing that, look, the people of Mashhad are religious. This is where they come for prayer and to go and visit the holy site. They're not here to listen to concerts and to music. Of course, you know, the more hardline sort of clerics believing that music, you know, should be limited in many ways anyway. And then you had this whole back and forth between the more conservative elements and the more reformist, is perhaps not the best way of putting it, but the more liberal, I guess, elements of the religious establishment saying, look, this is not a problem we should worry about. Let people have their concert. You know, nothing stops one of the holy sites in the country from having a cultural life that is not directly linked to religion. And then from there, you had all these questions about what, you know, the what a religious city, what a cultural, what, you know, religious culture, I guess, should look like in the country, and has really translated into the conversations that people are having today on the streets.
And then speaking of the conversations on the streets, who are the protesters? I mean, are they just regular Iranian citizens? Are we seeing any people aligned with political factions? And also, what are their demands?
So my understanding of this from, you know, the reporting I've seen is that what initially started this whole thing was actually a more hardline push and a more hardline kind of protest movement, if you want to call it that. And slowly, or I guess not so slowly, in a matter of a few days, it actually completely changed from sort of the hardliners trying to push back against Rouhani's agenda to then the broader population, the majority, it seems, from, again, the reporting that, you know, it's working class people coming out to the street and making demands that were very much related to the economy. So, you know, in that sense, it's a bit of a departure from previous movements, including, you know, people are pointing to 2009, the Green Movement, which started after the hardline President Ahmadinejad was reelected for this, for a second and final term. People are pointing to that movement saying, look, you know, there are contrasts here, there are similarities here. And I think the major sort of point of sort of what is different between the two movements seems to be that you now have a more working class majority as opposed to the more middle class composition of the Green Movement. In terms of the demands, you know, it seems like, again, this has been fairly centered around the economics. Most of the issues have been, you know, how do I make ends meet? How do my son or my daughter, who have, you know, a degree or several degrees in some cases, who are unable to get a job, how are they supposed to, you know, start a life, to make ends meet? And what is, what does their future entail? So the questions are very much the sort of pragmatic day-to-day issues that, that people are facing. That said, there has also been a kind of an intensification of the demands. People have started to question the, you know, broader policies, other political issues and social issues that that were not really part of this at the very beginning of the movement. Some of it is very much echoing what was going on in 2009 as well.
I mean, that is one of the basis of a lot of the tensions in Iran, is this reality that the Iranian society has a lot of young people that are highly educated, but with not a lot of prospects, which for society can cause a lot of problems. And it seems like we're seeing this stem into the discussions and the anger that we're seeing in the protests currently.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, one of the things that Rouhani has really grappled with, and I think that he will continue to grapple with for the next 2 years, is the issue of unemployment. You know, it's not enough to be able to show that you have the nuclear deal, that you have started to normalize relations with, you know, the with the Europeans anyway, that you have, you know, trade delegations, you have frequent contact with various leaders. What people want to see is actual change in their daily lives. And that seems like for the majority of the sort of, at least, you know, the working and middle class in Iran, that's not really the case. So you do have a population that is very much educated, relatively young, and that does not really have opportunities and prospects coming out of a 4-year, 6-year, or, you know, 12-year degree. So that, that does make it very challenging for Rouhani, who needs to be able not just to kind of show symbolically that he's signed a piece of paper or a piece of, you know, 160 pieces of paper, rather, is the nuclear deals is a huge document, but rather that you're able to kind of bring that into make it work and have that have an impact on people's lives.
Going back to the protesters, have the protesters seemingly been leaderless, or are we seeing groups of protesters that are advised by a leader, so to speak?
I think that's also one of the other major points of, you know, the major sort of differences between today and 2009 in that in 2009, yes, it was a grassroots movement. Yes, people were coming out, you know, organizing, using Twitter and sort of, you know, the I guess sort of traditional communications means, et cetera. But there was a leadership, right? You did have people whom the protesters were galvanizing around. So, you know, you had Mousavi and Karoubi who were representing the change that people wanted and who came to symbolize that. Today, that's not really the case. From what we're seeing, it seems like this is very much a grassroots movement. It's very much leaderless, and it doesn't seem like there is a cohesive sort of unified position or even agenda that people are pursuing. Again, you have the economic threat that links everything and everybody together. But you also have people who've been protesting the regime, you know, very fundamentally, sort of burning photos, images of the supreme leader, all the way to people who are saying, well, you know, I don't really want regime change. I don't want transition of power. What I want is basically to be able to buy eggs for my family. So you do have this sort of range that exists that is fairly different from what we had seen in the past.
What has been the reaction to these protests from the security forces?
So far, and you know, as we speak today, Friday, it seems like the protests have died out a little bit. It seems like things have been contained to some extent. But you know, the sort of response, for the most part, did not have to be as vast and as forceful as it was in 2009. The Revolutionary Guards have been deployed in a few places, it seems, and you know, you've had a range of reactions from various people in the leadership. So, you know, you had the Supreme Leader who said what you would expect him to say, which is essentially, you know, people are being you know, the foreign agents are behind the protests, all the way to somebody like Rouhani, who was saying things like, look, we need to listen to people. People should be able to organize, and we should take what they're saying into account. So you've had a range of views and positions on this, which, again, goes back to the infighting. You don't have a single way in which people in the establishment, in the security forces, are thinking about these issues. And one more thing I do want to highlight is that, you know, we tend to think of Iran security forces as this sort of monolithic hardline element, and that's not really the case. You do have a range of views, people who are more socially conservative, people who are less socially conservative. And so the reactions have been varied as well there.
And have we seen any level of violence? I mean, I have heard reports of high numbers of individuals being arrested, but as opposed to the 2009 protests, we saw, I feel like, much more violence on the streets.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, also it's important to note that the scale of these protests is very different from 2009. You know, in 2009, you had millions of people out in the streets. So the response, of course, had to be very different if the government, if the regime wanted to sort of, you know, crack down and effectively make people go back home and not come out again. Whereas today, that's not the case. You're not seeing millions of people. It's a much more, it's a smaller sort of movement, if you can even call it a movement, than in 2009. So the response has been sort of, you know, similarly has been different, has been on a smaller scale. The last report I saw was that there were about 20 individuals who were killed. There have been, you know, a number of arrests as well. I don't know if that number has gone up since I last saw it, but certainly that this is a very different scale from what we'd seen in 2009.
What has been the government's reaction towards the protests, and has the government had any negotiations with leaderless protesters, this leaderless movement, or are they just staying away from the people at this point?
I think it's too early to tell, you know, what kind of negotiation, whether, you know, it's a literal negotiation, essentially, you know, people sitting down with elements within essentially protesters, or some sort of unilateral concession by the government. I think it's too early to tell, since the protests seem to only be slowing down now after a couple of weeks. But from what I've seen so far, again, I think that people have reacted exactly how you would expect them to react, with Khamenei being much more forceful and sort of dismissing the protests as kind of a foreign backed movement. This is kind of what you're seeing from conservative and hardline social media accounts as well. And then, you know, it goes all the way to people within the government, Rouhani and his team, who have been talking about, listening to what the protesters are saying and to try to make adjustments and to try to accommodate them on some level. What I did see a couple of days ago was that their movements to try to movements is not exactly the right word, but the government is trying to, for example, adjust the price of eggs and lower the price of certain goods so that it can show to people that it's listening to them, that it's going, that it's taking their concerns into account, that it's going to try to address them. So I think what is important to watch in the next few days and the next couple of weeks is what kind of concessions are made by the government to the people, and whether or not people think that that's enough.
So we've talked a little bit about comparisons between the 2009 Green Movement protests and the current ones, such as the scale of how many people have been on the streets protesting, the level of violence, the demands. But I would like to talk about this a little bit more, and especially how in 2009 Tehran played a much bigger role in the protests than we are seeing today. Could we discuss this a little bit and the reasons?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tehran is typically at the center of these sort of movements because, you know, it's the capital. As you would expect with any capital, it is also where you have people from all over the country going to study, to work. So, you know, you're looking at millions of people in the city of Tehran. I think, and I don't have the exact numbers at this point, but I think it's upwards of 12 to 15 million people live in the city. And so you have people from all over the country who are going there to study in the universities and who are working there. So naturally, it's going to be one of the places that is going to be at the forefront of any kind of reform movement and protest movement. And that's been traditionally the case in Iran. You know, the revolution itself, the 1979 revolution, for example, is one of them. So it's sort of, you naturally expect Tehran to be the front and center, which is not the case here. And that's what is really interesting. It seems like, again, from the reports and not being there, it seems like the majority of the protests have been scattered around different cities and towns across the country. So that is an interesting sort of point of departure from 2009. And again, I think there's the element of class here that we also need to point out, that, you know, 2009 was very much the movement of the middle class. I happened to be in Iran in 2009, so I was, you know, sort of up close, you know, watching what was going on. And most of the people who were marching, you know, next to me were students, were people who were, you know, sort of young-ish, you know, post-revolution, the post-revolution generation, people who had not necessarily known the time of the Shah or even the revolution itself. So, you know, a kind of a different mix of people than what you seem to be seeing today.
And also, technology played a very big role in the 2009 Green Movement protests. And I think to an extent it probably is as well in these protests, but not at the same scale. And I'm sure that's for a number of reasons. I'm sure the Iranian government learned a lot from 2009 and how to prevent technology from being used to help movements. But what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, again, this is something that's a little, actually completely outside my area of expertise, but the few things that are interesting to watch are that, you know, Twitter was really was a galvanizing force, was a really important platform in 2009. People were using it a lot to signal where they were, you know, here's where the organization or the protests are happening, and also using it to communicate to the outside world what was going on in Iran at the time. And that was the first of these sort of movements. You know, later on, with you saw that the same thing with the Arab Spring, but it was the first one where Twitter and a social media platform was really at the center of what was going on. That said, I would also like to say that, you know, you've had accounts of the 2009 movement where people have said, you know, we've tended to exaggerate the role of social media. So I don't want to put this as a, you know, it's exactly what happened. It's a fact. It's, you know, it's disputed. But I do think that, again, based on personal experience, not being data or not being necessarily a stat, it was a helpful tool that people were using. What you're seeing today is that you, number one, have a range of social media platforms that people didn't necessarily have at the time. You have Telegram, WhatsApp, Instagram, you know, other media platforms I may not necessarily be familiar with. And you've seen a lot of the sort of, you've seen propaganda by hardliners, for example. You've seen counter arguments, counter messaging by the protesters play out in Instagram and Telegram. These various social media platforms were shut down briefly during certain days by the government. So Telegram, for example, was shut down at some point. I think WhatsApp was sort of in and out. You know, the obviously the government does see these platforms as both sort of an opportunity, right? It allows people to use it to for propaganda purposes. The regime does. At the same time, it also sees them as a threat in that they are a tool that allows people to galvanize to proliferate information about you know, what's happening on the ground, and to then communicate it to the outside world and to each other. What is interesting, though, is that I saw, I think yesterday, that the Chinese platform WeChat, which is kind of like their WhatsApp, I guess, they have started to open up to the Iranian market, and they're hoping to become the next, you know, Telegram. Telegram is the most popular, I guess, of these messaging apps in Iran, and WeChat is now trying to replace Telegram, and hoping to kind of you know, gain grounds there and present an alternative for people as well, which is typically the case. So what happens in Iran is that the government gets both the tools to censor, you know, various social media platforms from China and Russia, and then people then use different means to break the filter and circumvent the limitations to the access from Chinese and Russian companies as well. So that's always an interesting one to me, that, you know, they're selling both the disease and the antidote at the same time to the Iranians.
Very much so. Looking at the broader context of these current protests, what might they say for Iranian politics right now and in the near future?
Oof. This is a challenging one. Look, I think at least what we can say safely is a few things. One is that I think here in the United States, the administration is getting way ahead of itself in terms of the impact that it thinks or it wishes to see from the protests. You know, the major foreign policy changes that people hope to see from Iran, none of that is going to happen. Or at least you can say safely that they're, you know, with some confidence that it's not going to happen. Iran is not going to stop, you know, funding Hezbollah and supporting Hamas and the Houthis. It's also not going to fundamentally change the way it interacts with the United States and the West. So I think that that's the first thing is, you know, what the protests are not going to do, what they're not going to achieve is this sort of broader, big strategic shift in the way Iran thinks about foreign policy, security decisions. What it can do is it can get certain concessions. I think they're going to be more modest, more tactical, and more economic focused, and more domestic, I mean, 100% essentially domestic focused from the regime and from the government to the people. And so that's the space to watch, in my view, in the next, I would say, 3 years, you know, the remainder of Rouhani's term, and not so much what Iran does on the international front. The other thing that I think is interesting here, too, is that, you know, there is, and people often talk about, you know, what do Iranians want? You know, what does Iranian society look like? How does it, how is it different from the regime? And how does it see things, the policies of the regime? And I think that, you know, generally, the Iranian society has been pretty active. It's a very dynamic civil society. People are pointing to these protests as very rare. That's not true. You know, we've seen protests, you know, and reform movements and all kinds of movements in the past, essentially century in Iran. So it's a very dynamic and active civil society. And so, you know, you are going to see these sort of movements and protests occur from time to time. What I think is interesting is, you know, how the government responds and adjusts to them. In 2009, for example, the initial response was a crackdown, right, which was very forceful. You know, people were killed, people were imprisoned, the leaders of the movements were put under house arrest. They still are. And then things kind of died down. But at the same time, there was an impact. The impact of the Green Movement was felt on the 2013 elections and on what happened next. So it was a more dragged out, slower sort of impact than what people would have expected, I guess, or hoped. And I think that, you know, this is another place where something like this could happen. You may see the movement or the protest dying down slowly, you know, and may not necessarily see the changes in the immediate future, but you could see them down the line. So, you know, I think the problem is that we often tend to look at foreign policy and you know, domestic politics in other countries and hope for a quick, you know, shift in how countries do things. And that's more often than not the case, right? That these things happen, don't happen overnight. They happen slowly and gradually.
And on the flip side, what has been the Trump administration's reaction to the protests, and how have they woven in the nuclear deal rhetoric with these protests?
So the administration's response has been, well, the president has been tweeting a lot about the protests. You know, they caught his attention fairly early on. It's been one where he sort of posited that people are seeking big change, that they're finally waking up to what the regime is up to, and they're finally sort of, you know, becoming wise, I think, is the term he used to what the regime is up to. And sort of, you know, arguing that what the protesters want is, you know, Iran to stop funding terrorism abroad and to focus on its own citizens. This is the message that you've heard from a lot of other officials, but also lawmakers. So you've had, for example, Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, talked about, you know, the president wants to see an end to the support, Iranian support for terrorism. Vice President Pence said the same thing. And, you know, you've seen it from everybody from Marco Rubio to John McCain. So Senator Rubio, for example, tweeted it both in English and in Persian. So this has sort of been the message that people have been in the Beltway, essentially, have been sending to Iran and the Iranian people. I would say that there's a few things here. The first one is that I think the messages that the president and his team are sending are ill-informed on a number of levels, and they also tend to, as has been the case with his statements and remarks about Iran in the past, they are a little you know, insulting as they try to be complimentary. So, for example, he says, you know, the Iranian people are finally getting wives. Well, that's not true. The Iranian people have been fighting for their rights for a number of years now. You know, 2009, 1979, arguably didn't go the way most human rights experts would want it to go, but that was also a reaction to dictatorship and the lack of rights and so on, all the way to the early 20th century. So this is sort of insulting to the average Iranian who's looking and seeing that, you know, they have, you know, people died in 2009 and they're, and the president is saying, oh, you're finally waking up. You know, good morning, Iran. Well done. You're finally understanding what's going on in your own country. The other thing is that, again, I think the expectations are way too high in that, you know, this is not really about, you know, Iran's support for terrorism. This is not the main issue there. It may be tangentially related. Some people may have questions about it. Certainly, this is not, not everybody supports Iran's policies abroad in Iran. You know, it's been a controversial issue, but this is not the main thing that is driving the protests. And also, you know, you can't expect it to the protests to essentially end Iran's regional policies, because they're a completely different thing. They're, you know, Iran sees those as vital to its security. And it's a very different topic from what is happening today and the economic issues that people are protesting. So I think that, you know, the administration is sort of not fully understanding what's going on in Iran, and partly it's too early. You know, we don't have all the information yet. This is not a, you know, these movements are always messy, right? Protests are messy. Domestic politics are messy. It's not something that you grasp and you can explain in 100, well, it's no longer 140 characters, but whatever, however many characters you're allowed to use on Twitter these days. So, you know, these are complicated issues. And the problem is that the administration is looking for quick fixes and is looking for quick reactions. And this is not the kind of thing that lends itself to that. I think I forgot the second part of your question.
Oh, the nuclear deal. How has...
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I think the Senator Corker is actually the one who's captured this the best from my perspective among lawmakers and officials today. You know, he said that the protest should not impact how the administration thinks about the nuclear deal. And Secretary Mattis as well, I think today said something along the lines of, you know, we're not thinking, we're divorcing the issue of the protest from the nuclear deal as we're advising the president. And I think that's exactly the right approach for the administration to take. So, the president himself has been eager to link the two issues, but not in a way that makes a lot of sense. So he said, you know, the Iran has received a lot of benefits from the nuclear deal, but the people, he said the opposite of that this time around. He said, you know, despite the very terrible deal that the Obama administration had concluded, Iranians are not seeing the benefits and are not recovering economically from, you know, years of sanctions and isolation. And this is a bit of a departure from what he'd said in the past, which was, if you remember during the campaign, he kept referring to, you know, the Obama administration gave them everything. They went from essentially being a failed state to today being, you know, a very rich country that can spend all this money around the world. So it's a bit of a departure from that. But he's also not, in a way that makes a lot of sense, connected the two issues. So we don't really know if the protests are going to change the way he thinks about the sanctions waiver that is supposed to, you know, kick in a few days. The president is supposed to issue a waiver and decide whether or not he wants to continue the nuclear deal, essentially. And we don't know if that's something that he's going to think about as he's thinking about waiving the sanctions. That said, you know, again, I think Senator Corker and Secretary Mattis and presumably others are in favor of keeping the two, you know, compartmentalizing the two issues and keeping them separate. And I think that's the right way to approach the issue.
Well, we like to give our guests a moment, if time permits, which I think it does, to maybe touch on something that we might not have discussed in the conversation or to have a final thought. So I would like to hand the floor over to you for that.
I think I think we covered everything, twice or more. But I think you know what the big things to watch for as the protests continue in the next few days, and as we approach the deadline for the president to renew the sanctions waivers, I think it's important to number one look at how the government's response to the protests shapes what's going on the ground. Again, it seems like the government is beginning to provide certain concessions, dropping the price of goods and products, and seeing whether or not those things are going to essentially, you know, keep people happy and send them back home, at least until the next election cycle. So that will be a good indicator of whether or not this can become a broader movement, or if it's really just going to remain focused on people's day-to-day lives. The second thing to think about is, you know, Iran's regional activities and how the protests may affect what's happening there. Again, I think I'm not optimistic that what is going on domestically is going to affect how Iran is behaving in Yemen, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Syria. I don't see a lot of departure from past policies there, simply because I think that those are seen as a purely security matter. We can disagree with that characterization, but at least from Iran's perspective, this is about defending the country and making sure that threats don't come to Iran's own borders. So I don't see the protests fundamentally changing that viewpoint, and I don't think that the protesters are necessarily challenging that either. I think that to the extent that protesters have been talking about Iran's presence in other countries, there have been some slogans to that effect or support for various groups. They've been very much linked to the economic side of things and not so much to a broader ideological or security question.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Tabatabai, and especially with such a quick turnaround, because we sent out the invite fairly soon and you said you could be on the show in a couple of days. So I really appreciate it, especially with all of the developments that are taking place as we speak. So thank you so much for coming on the Loopcast.
That was really fun. Thank you for having me.